What are the broader implications of Britain's vote to leave the European Union? Does the Brexit vote suggest a major transformation of the current international order? Will a country such as Russia recalibrate its analysis of the global security architecture? What is the relationship between international economics and international security? Welcome back to The Connector, where we bring together innovative, groundbreaking, and collaborative research inside the UT Austin political science universe. I'm your host, Stuart Tendler. In this episode, Terry Chapman and Scott Wolford take us into a further discussion of the post-Brexit world. Scott ponders how Russia might interpret the vote. And moving to international economics, Terry draws comparisons between Brexit voters in the UK and Trump supporters in the United States, drawing historical comparisons between current events and the interwar period leading up to the outbreak of World War II.
So if we think about the security consequences of this, right? On one hand, it's easy to kind of worry because the U.S. has had this interest in European unity since the end of World War II because European disunity has been epically bloody, right, for a long time. And, you know, maybe you can kind of read the willingness of a lot of people to have a protest against the unaccountable bureaucrats in Brussels as being a product of the EU's own success, right? It just feels so safe, right, to leave. But you can also look at what's happening to the broader security architecture in that post-World War II global settlement that you mentioned earlier, Stuart, right, where countries that do profit from disunity in Europe, countries that are currently, you know, sitting on top of parts of Georgia and annexing peninsulas in the Black Sea and things like that, care about European disunity, and they will draw inferences, right, about European foreign policy, their ability to work together on linked issues. And security and economics are inherently linked, right? And we should, right, we should see a revision of how people believe or what countries believe about the stability and viability of the post-war deal, right, between the great powers. The UK threatening to leave, you know, it's bigger and in a military sense more important than, say, you know, other rejections of, say, the Maastricht Treaty that we saw in, what, the late 90s, I think, 07, 08, another country kind of rejected parts of the EU structures, but they're always kind of brought back, right? Seeing a big principle being willing to play with fire here will change how other countries view the kind of the coalition that protects the status quo. Right. The countries that should be happy with the current global system are the principals in the EU, the United States. You know, when they show that their house is not in order, that's strong, right? But when you see fissures and cracks, it's hard for me not to think that other countries, Russia, right, won't try to take advantage of it, you know. Now, does that mean anything immediately dangerous? Yeah, probably not, right? Like, the one other thing about being an academic is that we're inherently unlikely to believe that tomorrow's going to look much different than today, right? But I think you can still see the Brexit decision in the context of a sequence of other recent challenges to that global architecture, right? Where it's Russia, a member of the P5, forcibly changing an international border. Which, yeah, it got away with it, right? But that's a big deal. Like, that was kind of a clear, if implicit, bargain between the great powers. Is these borders are fixed, right? They're not going to be involuntarily changed. You see competing development banks in East Asia. You see China announcing that if this International Court of Arbitration decides against it, it's just not going to care. And you're seeing the British playing fast and loose with Western and Central European unity, right? Whether those add up to the kind of moment that looked like the pre-World War I era, I don't know, but I don't know that we can know, right? Like, if you can anticipate World War III, you're really going to try to avoid it, right? So big conflagrations like this are almost always going to be unpredictable by definition, right?
Yes, Stuart, and building off of Scott's last comment about the historical analogies here, you had mentioned that Professor McDonald was, saying the sky is falling, We like to make fun of Professor McDonald for his
daughter. That was conjecture, just for the record.
No, I hope he hears this. And
we're on the air, right? We have a hint at something. Let's speculate wildly.
Yes.
Let's go.
Definitely. I like it. I promised a freewheeling conversation, so.
Well, I think the World War One analogy, it may feel like that. It's a bit unclear to me whether it's the most appropriate. I actually think the 1920s and 1930s is what this evokes in a lot of people's minds, including Professor McDonald, just simply because of the populist economic politics of all this. So if we think about the people that have voted for Brexit have been compared to supporters of Donald Trump in this country. So what do these people have in common? They feel disaffected by immigration, by globalization, by large and long shifts in the underlying structure of their economies that's been caused by globalization, right? So these people, some of them actually, you know, Trump said in Scotland that this will be a good thing for Britain. And that's true. Anything like this has distributive consequences. It's true in the sense that it'll be good for some people, right? So let's think about what's happened. Well, the market's downgraded the credit rating on British debt. Mm-hmm. The pound has tanked, right? So that's actually good for some people, right? It's good in the sense he's right that it will attract tourism to Britain if people can you know, Europeans swallow their, you know, pride and want to go visit there for the cheap resorts.
It's like rubbernecking. It's like paying to rubberneck a car crash.
Yeah. Yeah. And we know people probably would pay that if it wasn't free, pay to do that if it's not free. But it's also good for British exports that have failed and failed to compete under, you know, with foreign products under globalization. But the big problem is that the share of the British economy accounted for by exports that have been harmed by globalization at this point is increasingly small. So what is Britain a chief exporter of? It's a chief exporter of things that make, as we know from political economy, this will sound like more academic jargon, but it's a chief exporter of things that make intensive use of the factors of production that it has in abundance. So it has capital, it has high-end labor, so financial services, things mm-hmm. like that, right? So this is why people in London oppose it, and this is why the financial markets oppose it, because this will be bad for, if this has trade implications and implications in terms of monetary and financial cooperation, this will be bad for the segments of the British economy that make the most money. Right. Mm-hmm. Sure. It'll be good for some people, you know, that had worked in the manufacturing sector that saw that have seen their wages drop steadily over the last 40, 50, 60 years as a result of changing trade patterns of the world. But the problem is that that's overall not going to be good for the country. So you're trading off economic stagnation, potentially. It remains to be seen how bad things will get, and it's hard to predict for a number of reasons. There are a number of government interventions that could help ameliorate this slide, but it's good for a few people, but it won't be good right. for everybody. Again, kind of a classic trade-off in political economy that we frequently see this when it comes to international trade, you know, all sorts of political issues, that there are distributive consequences, and the groups that are harmed, if they're concentrated, can oftentimes get their way, even if the collective outcome is suboptimal. Mm-hmm. Going back to the analogy to the interwar period, right? So the reason why a lot of people have become alarmed about this is that things are starting to look an awful lot like the early 30s when, you know, the United States passes the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Anybody seen Ferris Bueller? Ben Stein was the high school teacher, Smoot-Hawley, right? Largest across-the-board tariff increase in U.S. history, which starts off a round of responses by neighbors, right? So the details of this exit haven't been worked out, but it looks as if the European Union is not going to look so kind on giving trade concessions to a member that says, we want to exit the Union, but we want to keep all of our privileges, economic privileges with the Union, right? And it makes sense for them to do that. They want to deter other countries from following suit. But if that exit has trade consequences that sets off a reduction in trade cooperation, then all of a sudden we start to see countries facing harder times. This coming just not even 10 years after the 2008 financial crisis, there's still a lot of ramifications of that echoing throughout Europe. And we start to see wages in countries go down, unemployment go up, And that starts to look a lot like the domestic politics of some countries that became very belligerent during the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So this is the analogy. And I think this is, again, a spot where understanding something about international history and its connections to politics and how institutions operate would serve policymakers that are looking at potential things to do now in the wake of this. Mm-hmm. There have been analogies made between the Brexit voters and Trump supporters in this country. Their similarities, I think, are a lot of their similarities are that they're people that have become disaffected by globalization. They're probably making less than their parents were 50 years ago, probably barely able to afford, you know, raising a family, whereas they had a comfortable living growing up and things like that. And those people, you know, it's natural that they're angry and they're looking for a different way. But the problem is that pursuing these strategies of becoming more insular and retreating from integration is sort of like sticking your head in the sand when there's a bunch of elephants running at you, you know? You're not going to get out of the way of this, to mix my metaphors, right?
I thought there was a Dune reference coming. Yeah. I really did.
Sticking your head in the sand when a bunch of sandworms are rolling your way, right?
After you've been walking,
you don't want to do that. The Fremen and Dune know that you don't do that. You ride the sandworms, right?
This would be like walking with a very clear rhythm.
Yes.
Stopping, putting your head in the sand.
Right.
Decapitation.
So you want to take advantage of the wave and get on top of those sandworms.
Right.
Now we've totally lost Stuart.
Right.
I have the whole Dune series.
Oh,
all
right. No.
I can't say I've read it, but it's all there. I watched the movie many times.
You could have stopped just saying you had the series of the books. The movie's not that good. It's okay. We forgive you.
If nothing else, I hope this episode has shown you our faculty have at least a unique sense of humor, are well-read not only in political science, but science fiction too, and have culturally dated themselves, as I have given up assuming anyone currently in college has even heard of Ferris Bueller. More seriously, this episode has set the stage for the two episodes to come. Next time, we get significantly more in-depth about the complexity of navigating international politics. In a world lacking clear answers or simple solutions, just how do we make sense of persistent questions about war and peace? I hope you will join us. Until then, you can find me at gov.utexas.edu.